This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Pivot Points, historical moments that changed everything.
We are very pleased to have on the show with us again today, Matt Willis, who has written a number of works on naval and aviation history and was also the co-editor of the Random Writers Anthology. And I believe you've also published a number of short stories. Matt is with us today to talk about his latest project, which he's been working on with Jules, which is Oath and Crown, and is, oddly enough, historical fiction. So welcome, Matt.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. It's great to have you back. And this is a really exciting project. We've been looking forward to talking about this one. So thank you for coming to join us.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I feel a bit weird welcoming you back since I worked on it with you.
So. it's your podcast, and I guess it's a bit of a departure for the normal subject matter. So interesting to talk about.
Don't worry, we'll find a way to weave in the fairies somewhere or another.
And the dinosaurs.
5 minutes in, and you're talking about fairies.
I have a reputation to upkeep.
You have a fairy problem.
Actually, I'm beginning to wonder if we, and I seriously mean this, didn't have enough of the fairies in the Oath and Crown books, but I'll come back to that.
Yeah. Now you've intrigued me.
We'll go back to that. Anyway, just perhaps a little bit of background on what Matt, because we've been quite cagey, actually, on what Matt and I actually did. Mm-hmm. Oath and Crown is the collective name for, at the moment, two books.
At the moment.
At the moment, because I'm now quite keen to do another one, but I'll have to bully Matt into it.
I expect it won't take much bullying when we get into it. But
the first one was released fairly recently, and that's An Argument of Blood. And since Matt initially got me into it in the first place, why don't you tell us just a little bit about it?
Okay.
Well, I know about it, but tell Madeleine.
Okay. Oath and Crown is two historical novels, really culminating in the Battle of Hastings and the Norman conquest of England. And it was really about how we got to that point, how the world reached a point where there was this little battle in 1066. And we looked at the couple of decades before the Battle of Hastings, and from both sides, from the Saxon side and from the Norman side. And it was really about how the fates of these two countries and these two individuals that we chose. Shall I talk about that, or should we go?
Please talk about them.
Okay, so the two main characters in the books are William the Conqueror, William of Normandy, who was the Duke of Normandy from quite a young age, and Alfgifa, is that the? Because this is the thing, we've done it all in writing. I'm not actually 100% sure how some of these Saxon names are pronounced, which I probably shouldn't have admitted. But Jules,
yes, Alfgifa.
Okay.
Or Gifa, if you prefer.
Gifa, sure. Who was the youngest sister of Harold Godwinson, who was Jarl of Wessex and various other Jarldoms in Saxon England, and became King Harold II of England. And it was really that acquisition of the crown that led to the battle. So we have those two characters and what they're doing in the couple of decades before the Battle of Hastings, and how William goes from a really embattled duke who comes into his inheritance when he's in his minority. He spends much of his young life and really much of his adult life fighting to keep hold of his own territories, his own title, against neighboring nobles and even against his own king, the King of France. And
I think William spent most, in fact, you look back at William's life and he lived into his early 80s. So that was a fair old age then. And I think he spent a good 60 of those years in sieges.
You're probably right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. mainly besieging other people. And it was astonishing, really. But that was the style of warfare in France at the time. And that was another, pitched battles were rare because a pitched battle was really a single throw of the dice, and there was such risk involved in losing one that people didn't really go in for one. Far better to lock yourself up in strong walls and hope that your opponent got bored and went away, or you know, if you were trying to bring someone to battle, then you would end up having to either try and starve them out or batter down the walls or something like that. So whereas a pitched battle could decide things in a matter of hours, if you could go and besiege someone, then that might take years. And that happened with William. Really, the first major threat to his reign was in 1028. There was an attempted assassination, and approximately half of Normandy rose up against him. And he was able to secure the alliance of the King of France to try and defeat the nobles who'd risen up against him. And they were defeated at a battle of Valedun, possibly in 1028 or 1029. And that was done very quickly. But then his main opponent, Guy de Brion, went and locked himself up in his castle. And it was then another 4 or 5 years before he was actually defeated. So there was a lot. There was what I like to think of as William's siege phase, which was actually most of the time from 1028 until 1066, really. You seem to be besieging someone somewhere.
He just really liked it.
Yeah.
I don't feel alive unless I'm had a good siege.
No.
I think the interesting thing about the premise of the story is that, you know, the Battle of Hastings is something that we're taught in schools. You know, I still remember learning about the Battle of Hastings. In fact, I remember being reprimanded by my teacher for being too poetic in my essay and describing how, as the Normans retreated, Harold's forces broke rank and chased them. And I described how Harold must have closed his eyes in despair, thinking, "No, you fools!" And I sort of described his defeat and the way he died and stuff like that. My teacher was like, "This is very artistic, but this is a history essay, not a story." But it's great because we all know the Battle of Hastings. Even if people don't know the history behind it, the Battle of Hastings is something that everyone kind of, they're familiar with the name.
Yeah.
And yet it was literally the pinnacle of what happened, and it wasn't even the end. And it wasn't the beginning. And so much, it was just a significant, it was the pivot point, that battle.
It's
nice that you built up to why it happened, how it happened, and then sort of looked at kind of what happened afterwards, because the war wasn't over just because the battle had been won.
No, definitely not. And I think this is, part of why we chose to start it when we did, which is so much earlier than the battle itself, was that there was, I mean, the way we're taught the Battle of Hastings in this country, at least the way I was taught it when I was at primary school, is almost like things begin very soon before that. So you have Edward the Confessor, who's this wonderful, pious king, and whoops, he dies and doesn't have any issue, but he's promised it to his cousin, and okay, yeah, his cousin, fine, nearest relative, and Harold nabs it. William comes over and slaps Harold's wrist, and then kind of that's it. Whereas actually, looking into it more, there are so many factors that come into that moment, and as you say, it was the pivot point. It was actually, the more you look into it, the more certainly I realized, and I think kind of Jules had a similar kind of epiphany, was that chances of things happening the way they did actually seem minimal, and the possibilities for things happening a different way were legion. And the fact that shaped the whole way the country is now, and really shaped a lot of the world in the century since then. And you just kind of think, well, that was the crux of this whole business, when the world might have turned out completely unrecognizable.
Yeah.
But that didn't happen overnight, and those things were building up, and it came from the things that were happening on the Saxon side, which are described in Giefer's perspective, and the things that were happening on the Norman side, described in William's perspective. And I think there we've got these two we've got two quite good viewpoints for being able to see the how things progress. And I like that story you told, actually, Madeline, because that's almost the difference between history and historical fiction, and where historical fiction can do something that the history can't, which is you can really imagine yourself into it, and you can start to think, well, these things happened, but then explore the thinking behind it. And because in the 11th century, there's so little really good evidence of how things happened, why things happened.
Yeah.
A lot of it was written down later. The actual bare bones of what happened is pretty sketchy, let alone the commentary on it. Mm-hmm. So I think it's actually really useful for people like me and Jules to kind of imagine ourselves into those spaces and try and figure out why A led to B, which led to C.
To what Matt was saying about me having an epiphany, and yes, actually, I wasn't expecting to have to start it nearly 40 years before the battle. but looking at it...
Yeah, that was kind of my decision. Sorry about that. Although, actually, no, I think you did have your own...
No, I said I think I need to start it here when Aldite marries Edward the Confessor, because that's when the House of Wessex really went into ascendancy power-wise. They'd wielded a lot of power before that, but that was really... I mean, all the sons, there's something like 6, 7 Godwin children, legitimate ones. All the sons had yealdoms of their own as well. They were all recognised. Everyone in that family was... You know when you see, like, movie star families? And, you know, they've obviously come from wealth and influence, and they've gone into the family business almost. And it's not even nepotism. It's a case of, no, these people have been brought up to be as good as they can be.
Yeah,
that is pretty much what the main family of Wessex was like.
Yeah,
and it was really
interesting. It's not just now when we have lots of Baldwins. There was a whole string of Baldwins in the 11th century as well. But anyway.
But yeah, the Saxon situation politically was actually quite complicated. And it was so completely different to the Norman situation. And I hadn't heard of most of it because obviously the Normans won. So they wrote their own version of everything, which is the version we commonly learn.
Yeah, and that's the astonishing thing, really, that the teaching of it, or as I say, my experience of the story is that it was something that it came along and it happened, and that's it's the importance of it is understood, but almost in the sense that we, in some respects, see the beginning of the modern country from that point, whereas actually no, there was hundreds of years of Saxon and Anglo-Danish England before that. That's a legitimate, you know, it was a country in its own right. It was a powerful, wealthy country, you know, very cultured, in some respects, more cultured than Normandy. I mean, the Normans were Arivistes. They were the new kids on the block in many ways. So it was interesting to sort of get behind that writing of that kind of common understanding of history and look behind it.
It's fascinating. And historical fiction has always fascinated me because on the one side, you have this question of why would you want to read historical fiction, especially considering that you know what happens? And I think we've all read stories where you desperately want something else. You know how it's going to end, and you desperately want an alternative, and you almost believe that there might be an alternative because the characters you're following are so clever. But at the end of the day, Cromwell isn't assassinated, or you know, this, that, or the other doesn't occur, as you knew it wouldn't, because it's historical fiction. And so one might ask oneself, why would you want to do that? It's boring if you know how it ends. But at the same time, historical fiction around these pivotal points in history through which we are attracted, I think that it's attractive because these are stories that we are familiar with, but historical fiction often looks at it from a different perspective or a different angle. And suddenly these people who have been nothing but paintings, who have been two-dimensional characters from textbooks, become actual beings because we see their thoughts, we see their fears, and there's an emotional investment suddenly there, which can make the tragedy, which can make the victory feel more complete.
Yeah,
absolutely. And also I think the just coming back to that, the earlier point slightly, you can show the extent to which things weren't inevitable, the way things turned out was not inevitable, and why someone might have done something in a certain way, and you know, why those Bretons might have turned around and run away at the Battle of Hastings, and why the men in the Saxon Shield Wall decided to break the line and chase after them. And it's to the extent that we can be certain that something along those lines happened, yeah, but we have no idea what was in the minds of those men.
Yeah,
whether, you know, there's been a struggle over whether it was a deliberate faint or whether it was, you know, whether it actually was a retreat, or, you know, and then what happened afterwards, and did William take advantage of it? Was it opportunism? Was it deliberate? And, you know, it's the whole thing can be plotted in those kinds of terms. And bearing in mind anyway the fact that a lot of the time with the earlier history, even with such sort of major events, it's sometimes not clear within 4 or 5 years exactly when they took place and what the significance of them was at the time. So there's a huge gap to be that you have to try and backfill as a historical writer, to try and think, well, and I'm with Hilary Mantel on this. I don't know if you listened to any of her Reith lectures about writing historical fiction recently, but they really are worth listening to. And I'm definitely with her on the evidence being something that inspires and illuminates rather than something that's either in the way or something to exploit.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I tend to, being a writer of historical fiction, I tend to start with the evidence and then work out from that, rather than try and start with a story of something that I'm aware. I let the evidence lead the story, and quite often, you know, you don't have to look far to find it. There are stories there. It's not something you have to shoehorn in.
No, yeah. And I must ask, but you come from a historical background, don't you? And you studied history, and you've obviously worked in naval and aviation history in the non-fiction sector as well, so you are a researcher by nature.
Absolutely. But with my first non-fiction book, and this was something that was quite pleasing actually, you find a story, a narrative arising, and it's not something you have to create or something you have to embellish. It's just something that's there, and you find yourself reading this history and going back into the documents and the evidence of the day. And it's something I think story is as important in my non-fiction work as it is in my fiction writing.
Yeah, I mean, I found when we were being asked a few questions about the whole co-writing process, I was saying that obviously I don't have a lot of experience as a historical fiction writer, but it's more of a case of it being a why done it rather than a who done it. Because you know who did it and what happened, but why did it happen? And there's the gap of 1,000 years almost standing between us and them mentally. So it's why people would act in that way, and trying to put yourself in that mindset.
I have to bring this up now because Jules, during the writing period, did impart to me that actually it felt was quite spooky. That actually, just as Matt says, the evidence informed the story, but you actually found that the direction you were going in, there was a lot of evidence supporting what you'd already been thinking. Is that right?
Yeah. It was spooky at times, because when you get so immersed in the work, you get so immersed in your writing and the characters and the story, it can sometimes, and in the evidence, I certainly sometimes find it there comes a point when I'm not sure what I've made up and what I've drawn from the evidence. And it came, I think both of us found that we'd be writing something and then we'd find some piece of evidence when we were doing further research, because we were researching as we were writing. I mean, we did a phase of research beforehand, but then we continued at the sources to as we went through to sort of fill things out. And we kept finding that things that I thought I'd extrapolated, there would be evidence that actually happened. And there was one quite major one that we sort of came across on probably about three quarters of the way through writing, which was, it did get spooky. And you kind of think, well, actually, I mean, either we've immersed ourselves so much in the evidence and in the time and in the characters that that we've actually started to, it's real enough that our imaginings fit very well with what was happening, and they fit so well that we can actually, when we think we've extrapolated something, it was the thing that actually happened in real life. But it can feel very, very, very spooky, like you like almost, well, you're bringing it back to life and making it happen somehow.
Yeah,
it was one thing we thought we were taking quite a big liberty, where we took a character who, in fairness, we didn't know whether this particular character even survived childhood, so I was kind of already taking a liberty there anyway, and put her in France, basically. And we thought, well, you know, it's not completely off the wall for this character to be there, but then you dug up something and said, just look at this.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, I really thought I made that up.
Yeah.
See, I'm convinced you guys were possessed by the spirits who wanted the story to be told. I've told Jules this over and over. She was clearly possessed.
Which is what you want to be told when you've just dug up something a bit weird.
Yeah.
I aim to please.
But it can feel like that. You get to know the character so well, and when it was a real person, it's kind of especially one about who we know very, very little. Mm-hmm. That you do kind of think, well, yeah, that's, you're channeling them a little bit, which is I don't know if that's a dangerous attitude. I mean, I think as long as you sort of remain grounded about it, then, you know, it stops you from going too nuts. But yeah, I think it's a good thing when you feel that, because it means that your character is living and breathing. Broadly, people have said to me, William's not very likable, is he? Apart from one person who said, William's too likable. and it depends on your perspective. And, you know, as far as William's character is concerned, what I looked at was not so much what people wrote about what he was like, which was all very much influenced by, you know, the Norman perspective, and it was Norman biographers in some cases writing sometime after the event. But if you look at the plain fact, in some, as far as we know it, what he did, and you can draw a certain amount about what someone's like from what they did, and even how, you know, when certain gloss is put on certain things, you know, it's you can start to draw out the, you know, you can start, as Jill said, the why done it, and you start to sort of explore the psychology of how you get from one point to another, really.
Yeah,
I mean, I am still a bit staggered that the Battle of Hastings fell out the way it did, because when you look at it, if you take Harold Godwinson and you take William of Normandy, Harold pretty much had everything going for him. He had all the advantages, sort of socially, education wise and, you know, as a person. I think people followed him because he was incredibly charismatic. That's certainly why the Witnessmot actually probably picked him. It would have been an influencing factor, because Edward the Confessor, for all the great press that was given for him, actually probably wasn't that great a guy.
And William Spence grew up with a lot of people trying to kill him quite frequently. in all probability, never learned to read. He was not a. And you know, again, there's no sense that he had this sort of kind of winning personality that it appears that Harold had. And you know, he was growing up in the shadow of a king who had been heavily indebted to William's father and was very keen to win back some of the territory that he'd been forced to gift him. You know, he really didn't have a lot going for him. And yet, not only did he manage, and as I say, he spent much of his life fighting to secure what he had, as well as trying to make some modest expansion. And, you know, and then the fact that someone who's been really forced to look inward for most of his life, and fighting off enemies from just about every quarter, then somehow ends up winning the throne of this large, prosperous, powerful kingdom. You know, and even the circumstances in which the battle happened, in which you know, it was very unlikely the way it fell out, the way it feels to me.
Yeah, Now, speaking of, because something you've done with this book, with this duology, is that actually both of the characters are based on real people, which is a very, it's a very tough thing to do, because again, we, as especially if you know anything about history, you kind of know where it ends, you know where they're going to end up. You know, it's an excellent chance to dissect a character and get to know them, but it can be very, very tough. And some historical fiction does that. So we've mentioned Hilary Mantel. So Wolf Hall obviously follows, what's his name?
Oh, Thomas Cromwell.
That's the ticket. That's the monkey. I'm sorry, I'm not a big fan of Wolf Hall, not going to lie. I really didn't like it, and I really didn't like him as a character. Yeah, you've got Wolf Hall that does that, and you've got a lot of the Philippa Gregory books, which follow queens and Anne Boleyn and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But in her case, she tends to add a fantastical element as well, which sort of brings up a whole new sort of layer to the stories. But some historical fiction does it a little bit differently, where they create a new character within an environment which is already familiar. And actually, I think one of my favourite times that this has happened was the TV show called Rome. I don't know if either of you ever watched it. It was very bloody. It was very silly at times.
Yeah, I ended up watching. I've seen it so many times now because it's one of Alan's favourites. So every so often he just wheels it out and I end up having to watch it again.
Well, I mean, the thing is that what they did then was that they had historical events and then actually looked at what actually triggered them. So there's a whole bit where there was a historically this massive riot. And in the show, it turns out that it was actually triggered by Pulo getting into a fist fight with someone whom he owed money to. And it triggers this entire historical change with Caesar and all that. And yeah, and what they did was that it was set around these times of great change. And again, another Roman one is the Roman Mysteries, which are based by Caroline Laurent, their children's books, which are based during some of the most active years within the sort of the Roman Empire. So they're there when Vesuvius erupts. They meet Pliny the Elder, you know, things like that, where they meet characters, people who were real, but the story still has a
dynamicism.
Thank you, dynamicism to it, because you may know the fate of where they're at, but you don't know the fate of these characters themselves. And very often what they do is that they introduce a character who we all know historically, and then sort of they weave in and out of their lives. So again, another Philippa Gregory book, The Queen's Fool. You've got a made-up character who becomes a maid to both Queen Mary the First, Tudor, Mary Tudor, and also knows Elizabeth Tudor.
Yeah, I think there were those two major advantages in doing that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the first is certainly for medieval Tudor history, well, and with a lot of history, really, in that we know a relatively large amount about the political classes and the ruling classes, but relatively little about individuals in the, you know, in the lower classes. So if you're going to look at that aspect of you know, the experience of the vast majority of people in those eras, mm-hmm. then you kind of have to, a lot of the time, fall back on a made up character. And also, I think, as you say, it can help introduce elements of uncertainty in the fate of the characters, which, yeah. I mean, I actually think I didn't find that a huge problem with tackling real characters. I mean, not least in that, because we know relatively little about, you know, the level of evidence there is for the 11th century compared with even the 13th or 14th century is tiny.
And again, but, this was a period which was not very well scripted. Like the Roman period was very well scribed. Yes, it was always inscribed in favour of the Romans, but they kept records of everything. Mm, and actually, after the Romans disappeared, those records, there wasn't as much keeping of records.
Mm, mm. But then again, I mean, the records, the recent spat on social media about the ethnic diversity of Roman Britain attests. there are actually some things in the records that obfuscate rather than illuminate, in that people who were part of the who were kind of citizens of the Roman Empire tended to take on Roman names. So you can't learn a great deal about, you know these people and you might know roughly where they're from within the Roman Empire, you might not, but you can't be entirely clear and you don't know necessarily what their background is from their name, because that's something they've taken on themselves and it's something to reflect their Romanness rather than their origin. So yeah. Again, there's a lot of space in there for confusion and argue. But yeah, it's the records and the extent to which the records are available can be a help and a hindrance. And
see, character-wise, I felt I had a bit more of an advantage because I picked someone who was so little known and about whom there is so little written that I actually genuinely thought I was making up a character. And until you sort of dug up a few things later on.
Yeah.
Even then, it wasn't very conclusive in the sense of, well, it would appear to be talking about the same person who disappeared from the record for about 20 to 30 years after her birth was sort of recorded. And it's like, well, why would you keep somebody that low key? Or, you know, why, when you think about how well, for the time, all of the rest of the Godwin children were actually documented.
Yeah,
why was so little written about this person? And I've tried to explain that a little bit in the book.
Yeah, but then, as you say, I mean, if she'd been another Edith, then we'd never have suspected.
No.
So, yeah, it might be the same person, it might not, but then it's there's a lot. But it seems to be a much rarer name. There's even suggestions of were there two sisters or actually were there one and that's just two versions of the same name. So yeah, but then as you say, the rest of them, there's you know, we know the bare bones and with this one or possibly two, probably one, it's just so vague. And that in itself is, I mean, it's intriguing, but it tells you certain things. You can extrapolate certain things from that, but you know where you took it. I mean, it depends whether you what you regard as an easier job or not. I mean, I think that I still had quite a lot of flexibility with, you know, after having picked William, which was kind of the brief from the publisher, really. But there was enough flexibility within that, and there are lots of, you know, there are a fair number of novels about William the Conqueror, and each of them takes a slightly different take on his character, but it's, yeah, I think actually the direction that I wanted to take with that, or that I thought I should take, was quite apparent from the beginning. And you know, it's very easy to see him as a very straightforward character who there wasn't a lot to, but then I think he wouldn't have achieved what he did if he'd just been this brute that some people kind of think that he was. So yeah, it's a fascinating process, but as you say, when you start to get to know them, it's difficult to think of them any other way, really.
Now, I must ask you, because one of the themes, obviously, of this episode is looking at the sort of the pivotal point in history, pivotal points, rather. There's not just one, that one point in history that changed everything. And we are drawn to these moments. And I think it's fair to say that Tudor England, moving into Stuart England, was a hugely pivotal point, especially in regard to sort of European history, because you had that change of religion, you had this whole mess with the kings, you had civil war. So it's not surprising that we do have a lot and a lot of fiction based in that era. So if we just disregard the Tudors very briefly, what would you guys say are some of the other very significant pivotal points in history where fiction is focused, and are there points in history where you feel like fiction should be focused more?
I'm not sure if fiction's focused here, but the death of Franz Ferdinand, which more or less started off World War One, which led on to all sorts of things, which I expect Matt knows more about than I do, in fairness.
it's an interesting one, that, because that was the match that lit the
powder keg,
really. Yeah, and it was there, but you kind of think, well, if the match hadn't necessarily been struck in that way, might it have fallen out differently? And it's my big one, I think, was probably, I mean, I would not limit it to Tudor England. I would say the Reformation as a whole, and how that really did, you know, that Martin Luther and his 95 theses you know, developing what became Protestantism, how that really did just set this cultural tidal wave across Europe. And but there, you know, but there had been episodes before of, you know, what were regarded as heresies that had risen up and then been stamped out. And if that hadn't happened in Europe in the same kind of way, would Calvin, you know, had he arrived a little bit earlier, would that have just been stamped out and then that wouldn't have happened? The French Wars of Religion and so on and so forth. So it's the fact that this particular spark caught at a particular time in a way that it could then spread. And it was very much the same with the First World War, that mm-hmm. particular instability in the Balkans, and then you had it ran into the sort of the imperial ambitions of Germany, and the fact that France and Germany seemed to go to war approximately every 30 or 40 years. And
we have a schedule.
I think the fact that probably a lot of people at the time thought, you know, this is just going to be another one of those European wars which breaks out periodically, only it didn't. It spread out much wider and it became much more, it wasn't, you know, like you look at the Franco-Prussian War of 1870, that happened, it was over relatively quickly, it had various knock-on effects, but, you know, it wasn't, it didn't sort of set ablaze to an entire continent the way the First World War did. So, yeah, I mean, it's, you can only see looking back, and there are those, the fascinating thing for me is, do people who are there at the time have any concept of times of change they're living through? Yeah. And I think one that I'd mention actually, which is I think probably falls on the side of, there isn't much fiction about it and there probably should be, was the withdrawal of the Chinese Empire within its own borders, the decision to just stop being what we regarded as a you know, an empire building nation, sort of mm-hmm. spreading its tendrils out into the rest of the world and influencing and taking over territory and things like that, which I think was probably round about in the 14th century.
Yeah, that's right. I do actually know a reasonable bit about this, but yeah, and it's a huge one because technologically they were so far ahead of the Western world. As in, they had gunpowder, they had proper ships, they had a proper naval-type fleet way before us. They had things like...
Way bigger ships than we did had in Europe.
They were using things like paper money back in the 12th century, which seems like such a small thing. But when you think about being able to trade on the huge scale, because before that it was strings of coins, and you can only carry so many coins, and it just makes such a big difference.
It makes economics possible, which, you know, makes the modern world possible. It's so I think that's the thing for me. And it's possibly not focused on so much because it's an absence almost. It's a withdrawal. It's something that it's harder to pin down what the effects of it might have been. And also there's just the sort of tendency of people to be Eurocentric about history, and the tendency of European history to be very Eurocentric in its outlook, and then, you know, American history is kind of the same by extension. So that was a big one for me, really.
Put forward the Spanish Armada as well, the first one, because it completely, you know, it sort of gave confidence to the rise of Protestantism as well. It sort of established English superiority as a naval race, and that potentially sort of led on to the beginnings of the British Empire, which was a huge, obviously, cultural influence everywhere.
Yeah.
I'm not saying we obviously started going out conquering.
No.
During the 1600s, but getting that sort of, establishing that naval dominance that early on.
And I think in the way that it was a sort of David versus Goliath thing, which I imagine it had a similar effect on, you know, English confidence and the sense of the kind of nation England was at that time, as the American Revolution, and the fact that was a sort of a small, relatively young country. Obviously, England wasn't a young country, but you know, kind of punching above its weight against these mighty established powers. So there probably was a sense in a certain part of the population that was, you know, they were there at the beginning of something, and you know, it was a country that was moving forward, and so on. I think, yeah, the effect. I mean, there's a wonderful old history novel called Pavan by Keith Roberts, about which is set in around about the 1960s England, in a world where the Spanish Armada succeeded.
Yes.
So the Industrial Revolution hasn't fallen out in the same way. You know, the Inquisition is still very powerful. You know, technology is very different to how it is. And there is this firm, almost kind of concrete belief in the fairy folk. And I think I may have mentioned this the last time I was on the show, actually. But yeah, you know, I know how you love to talk about the fairy folk, but. And I think that was where my point was about Oath and Crown, in that where you, when you try and get into the medieval mindset, mm-hmm. the belief in the supernatural as really quite real and influential on your life is something you've actually got to kind of bear in mind a lot of the time. And I think we did do that. You know, that there was that sense that you know, is it fantasy if it includes these things because the people themselves believe they're real? It's a difficult, you know, difficult dividing line.
I mean,
we did
mention it because obviously Gifa's deformed, so
and
the strong belief at the time was that either God or the fairy folk, but particularly God, marked out his disapproval of a human soul by giving, you know, the outer casement, if you like, a deformity. So that was God say, if you were born deformed, that was kind of God saying, you know, this is not one of mine, I'm marking it out as one of the devil's, kind of thing. And that, you know, it was a prevailing belief. So people quite often were, well, you say it's discrimination, there was no such thing as discrimination, but they tended to have quite rocky lives due to that. And then if you have somebody who's nobly born who looks like that, well, obviously they've got a bit more influence if their parents are willing to own them and raise them, as it were, or at least if one parent is. But at the same time, there's still that stigma following you through your entire life, particularly if it's a deformity you can't hide.
Yeah, which is the case with this character.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. And also, I think the interesting thing about that and the way you handled that particular issue, Jules, was the, again, this sort of ongoing long-term shift in beliefs from the sort of the old beliefs that were very much the sort of the old, you know, Germanic, you know, and sort of beliefs in a more sort of pagan belief system, and a, you know, sense of there being various, you know, wood spirits and water spirits and so on, into the Christian mode of thinking. And there's this sort of, we're at this midway point where people still kind of believe in both and have a sort of a way that isn't quite comfortable of synthesizing the two, you know, so people can still talk about, you know, the fairies, you know, the elves, you know, returning or switching people, but at the same time talking about God having marked them out as not one of their own. And you know, I think that's a really interesting side to that whole sense of how things are at the time.
The religion was an interesting thing to tackle because as everybody learns in school, it was Christian, supposedly. What you don't learn is that Christianity was quite fragmented at the time. So you did have the Roman Latin Church, but there was also the Celtic Rite Church over in England. And then you probably still had large areas of pretty much pagan belief around parts of the British Isles. And the Celtic Rite Church itself wasn't actually united. It was quite divisive.
Well, there was no single church, and
no.
So there was no single church in the way there was with the Roman Church. And again, I think that the thing from the Norman side was, you know, from the European side generally, was just how unreligious a lot of the religious structures were, and how you had these bishops who weren't really at all like clergy that we would imagine, but had just been installed in a particular role, you know, because it was a powerful office. Bishops that went into battle and, you know,
you wouldn't think he was a bishop, really, because and from the accounts as well, he just seems to spend most of his time not so much producing sermons, but going into battle, waving a sword.
Yeah.
Is this?
It's William's half-brother.
Oh, right.
Who was made Bishop of Bayeux at the age of 18. So,
as you do.
Yeah, because he was such a remarkable student. But yeah, and also, you know, before that you had this sort of bishop, Mogère, who was the bishop of Rouen, who was really not very pious at all. And yeah, the rumours have come down to us now, almost established that he effectively had a concubine, if not several. It was said of him at the time that he kept his rivals in line because he was rumored to have a demon at his command who he would set on people who weren't who stood up to him. So
I'm trying to remember who was the Pope at the time. Was it Pope Innocent III? I can't remember, but
I think there were about four popes during the whole, if not more than that, during the whole narrative. And I tended to lose track of who was, kept having to check back as to who was Pope at a particular time, because
I'm pretty sure they had concubines and children, and
one
of them even kept a brothel for his own personal use. I can't remember which one it was, but over here in England they were sneering Christianity in Saxon England because they had mixed monasteries.
Yeah.
Where you had monks and nuns who allegedly were living vows of chastity, who knows? But, you know, just because they were working together, men and women together.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big no. Apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, the gender politics of Normandy and Norman France and Saxon England was quite interesting as well, I think.
Yeah.
Completely different. You had far more rights as a woman in Saxon England. The Normans probably set us back a couple of hundred years with that.
Yeah, that was the sense I had, was that it was, you know, if not, I mean, because the echoes of that are still with us today, really, I think. It's just even the fact that it wasn't necessarily what the Normans introduced, but the fact that for a long time, for a couple of hundred years, really, you had a political, certainly for 100 years, you had a political class who spoke a different language, who were culturally very different from the ordinary people. And I think that's where the British class system essentially has its roots. Not that things weren't distinctly hierarchical under the Saxons, because they were. We don't want to sort of create this sense of a utopian Saxon England where all men were equal, because it very much wasn't like that at all. But certainly what happened after the Battle of Hastings, you know, and in a sense that you hadn't, because obviously there'd been the Danish conquests, you know, in the decades before, earlier in the 11th century, and how Britain had been an Anglo-Danish nation really for some time, but culturally it stayed very much the same. And, you know, you hadn't had these big shifts in the way that you did, you know, really. I mean, it didn't change immediately after William's coronation, and even, you know, necessarily within William's remaining lifetime. But I think and there's evidence that William actually did make some attempts to allow the English population to retain its unique culture, in the sense that that was how they understood it. But certainly to keep doing things the way they'd been doing them. And it was only the sort of ongoing insurrections and uprisings and people attempting to take the throne back for the Anglo-Saxon population was that really then you started to see things like the harrying of the north and the really cultural cleansing of the sort of upper echelons of English life that really started to then change England into a much more Norman country.
Yeah. Now, there's something I want to ask you, considering your research background, specifically in military and things like that. I've often held on to this belief that perhaps the reason why the Roman Empire was so successful in its beginnings was because of the fact that it adopted things as it conquered places and allowed people a certain liberty to continue living as they were. It didn't force them to change religions. It didn't force them to do anything like that. Do you feel that that was something that sort of, as you guys were writing, and as you guys were looking into this period of history, the cultural changes and things like that were also a big part of why you had to build up the story from so far back and why it didn't just end with the Battle of Hastings.
I think so, to a certain extent, because in order to really understand why the Battle of Hastings was a pivot point that actually changed probably the history of Europe, quite possibly the history of the world to a certain extent, you had to understand why these two different cultures clashed in that way, and why exactly it wasn't just a case of, oh, someone's stolen my chair and my hat and I'm going to go to war over it. It was really important that there was a whole lot of propaganda going on from the Norman side. You had William's supporters going around saying that Harold was a forsworn man. That basically means you're forsaken by God. So the outcome of the Battle of Hastings was huge in its influence for Europe as a whole, because it was literally as if God was answering a question. And it's really difficult for us to keep that in mind nowadays, that something might be decided on that scale by a battle. But it literally is a case of, well, it'll be God's will at the end of it. Not that everyone accepted it that way, but a general consensus. And then obviously it supports the Latin Church, which really wanted everybody under the same umbrella, because they were quite big on control and still are to a certain extent.
Yeah, I mean, even things like the different ways in which an oath could be understood and exactly what an oath of homage meant. And, you know, just I think in some cases it was a bit of a culture clash in that sense. But also there was the politics, as you say, on both sides, that both sides had their own narrative of what different things meant. And yeah, I mean, it was, and I think in a way that it hadn't been with the Danes in the previous centuries, then, you know, the cultures, I think, there were probably a bit more similar. And yeah, it didn't, and again, I think that there was the church in, you know, the Latin Church, which was just starting out really with this this process that throughout the whole, well, until the Reformation would be this sort of immense power grab. And I think that there's, you almost get this sense that the Roman Empire almost continued through the church somehow, to an extent it did, and its methods became political rather than military. But I think, again, you always had the sense of the slight independence or semi-detachedness of the English church, which I think kept coming back. And there were various times in which, I mean, the Reformation, it was a huge break, but it wasn't the only such break, nor did it turn up without any warning. There had always been the sense that the English church was always pulling slightly against the Roman one, and that sort of had its roots in the pre-Norman situation. So
I think the mindset, because obviously you had, as you said, there were all the Danish invasions, and the mindset from the combined cultures after Alfred had finished sort of making it one kingdom, as it were, was very different. But it was oddly liberal in a lot of ways. The Dane law was quite protective of vulnerable people, certain sectors of vulnerable people. You could earn, we still kept slaves.
Of course, naturally.
but you could earn your freedom, and the slaves were protected. You weren't allowed to just abuse them. There were hefty fines. There were punishments for abusing your slaves. From medieval mindset, that's quite advanced, really. That's quite liberal. Obviously, keeping slaves isn't great.
No, and that was the sort of the weird things that seems to cut against the grain of when William did become king. Slavery, as it was in place, was effectively outlawed. But on the other hand, being a serf under a Norman lord was not a great situation to find yourself in. So it's and in many ways I think serfdom was effectively a kind of slavery, or kind of bonded labor.
You were probably worse off as a serf, because you weren't actually allowed to leave and go somewhere else. You were then considered almost like a runaway servant. And the punishment for that could be anything from a flogging to hanging. So being a serf wasn't great, whereas being, if you like, being a Saxon serf, you might actually have a very nice life. It's just that in name you weren't free. But if you were serf to an established family, and it didn't even have to be a politically powerful family, it just had to be a bit wealthy, you might wear very nice clothes, you might have your own jewels, you might have your own servants. Very bizarre. And then
you had this sort of system of influence through folk moots and so on, right up to the Witan, which was, you know, kind of, I don't know how effective it was in terms of channeling up, you know, channeling influence to and from the very lowest folk, but so you certainly had nothing like that really under the Normans.
There was more of a meritocracy in trying to put kings on the throne with the Witnesgemot rather than, and to be fair, you had, I don't know, dozens of Witnesgemots over the years, right up until the point where the old king dies, and then the most influential Witans would come together. By then, they probably already had an idea of who they were going to elect, because that person would have been probably courting their favour or making themselves known. So it's very much like a presidential election in that respect.
Yeah. And by and large, it's probably more often than not, it was the candidate that had been nominated by the previous monarch who was by and large one of their children, if not the. But I think, yeah, this is a system of primogeniture and then the divine right, again, very much comes along after the Norman invasion. I think you see this in Macbeth, where actually, you know, the historical characters on which that's based, those kings were elected. Mm. And in both England and Scotland before the Norman invasion, it was that was the custom, was that the king would be elected, and it would, you know, it wouldn't be a democratic election as we understand it now, but no. This sense that it would automatically pass to the eldest male child of the previous monarch, and that bloodline had been blessed by God was really an import from Europe, courtesy of the Norman conquest. And so you then have this situation in the 17th century when Shakespeare is writing about it and is writing his history plays, certainly Macbeth, very much in the sense of the divine right of kings and the primacy of a particular bloodline, about a situation that wasn't, he was completely imposing that on the history as it was.
Yeah, of course, but you know, he had someone to please.
Of course, and that was he was doing that for nakedly political reasons.
Yeah,
and that's fine as long as we understand that.
No, it was historical fiction has just got so many facets in that respect, because, I mean, it can really make you completely relook at history. And if we, I think we're going to need to finish relatively soon. So before I ask you guys a little bit more about the books and availability and stuff like that, I just want to talk about Macbeth actually as a piece of historical fantasy.
Hmm.
And the significance of it as a piece of historical fantasy. It was, as you say, it was a very political piece. And yet it's fantastic to study because it actually tells you a lot about the period of history that it was written in. It tells you more about that than it tells you about the actual history itself. And in some ways, how we write historical fiction now will probably be a big telltale for future generations of how we observed the world around us, what our morality was, and also how we observed the past, given all of the improvements we're making with archaeology and sort of understanding the world and the past. You know, it's only going to become clearer as time goes on. You know, you mentioned the sort of the Roman Britain and what was it like, and, you know, obviously archaeological digs and stuff are actually finding people of all sorts of ethnicity all over Britain historically, because, you know, as we know, the Roman Empire employed, that the Roman army employed people from all over the world, all over their empire. So you had an assortment of different people who were in Britain during the occupation of the Roman Empire. But looking at Macbeth, it was, there's so many references to what was happening at the time. So the inclusion of witches, for instance, was literally just because James I was obsessed with witches and was absolutely sure that they were the ones who were sending storms to kind of destroy him. Which is pretty much why the whole inclusion of witches was there. I think Shakespeare was just trying to sort of appease James I and actually ended up scaring him so badly the play was banned initially, because James was so terrified of the witches at the beginning that it was banned. But yes, you had the fact that his history was changed. Macbeth, who won rulership from Duncan in a fair battle, I believe, and it was Macbeth himself who was actually assassinated. I might be wrong in that, but I know that he didn't assassinate Duncan. He did face him in battle.
Yeah, I believe that it was a situation where Duncan was beginning to become tyrannical. Mm-hmm. And with broad support, Macbeth, as you say, faced him in battle and defeated him and was elected king.
Yeah.
You know, reigned for quite a long time reasonably well from all accounts. Yeah. And then began to get a bit tyrannical, and then the same thing happened to him.
but it was definitely that Duncan was not the righteous good king. You know, at the end, he was a tyrant when he was killed, and the same with Macbeth. But again, the betrayal was very much about appeasing James the First.
And you know, to the extent where James the First appears in the play, and there's this idea that I thought I was talking about earlier about the inevitability of history, when Macbeth sees the vision of all the future kings of Scotland leading up to someone holding a mirror. And the idea being that mirror is supposed to reflect the face of James I, who's actually sitting there watching it, and that he sees himself at the end of this line of monarchs that have sprung from, you know, all the way from Macduff. And sorry, it's not Macduff, is it? It's Fleance who?
Yeah, Banquo's son
who becomes king. And he's kind of back engineering this history that the creating a national myth that the new king can get behind. So, but yeah, I mean, there's a sense in which obviously Shakespeare was doing that deliberately. There's also a sense, as you say, that we cannot help when we write, we cannot help reflecting the discourses of the time and the attitudes and social mores and so on of our own time. And I don't think there's anything that we can do to, you know, you can never set a work of fiction outside of the time in which it's created. I think the best you can hope to do is what I think we've done, which is to try and engage with the evidence honestly and, you know, in good faith, and to actually regard it as the source of what we're doing, and to reflect it, to have everything reflect that rather than be something we're trying to shoehorn a particular narrative or message into.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it ended as I expected it was as it would. I think it became a very different book than the one I was, you know, I vaguely had in mind at the beginning. Well, not at least in that it became two books.
Yeah.
Completely overshot our word target.
Yeah, by how much?
We overshot we overshot it by about 135,000 words.
Well done.
I think it's more than that in the end. It was about that. Yeah, but I think because it became much more complex, and because it was just that when we were immersed in that world and those characters, life was more complex, and the whole thing was. That's just how it went.
Well, I think we've run out of time. So before we depart and we say goodbye, I just want to ask you. So Argument of Blood is now out,
mm-hmm.
I believe.
Yeah.
And it can be bought through the usual channels online and on Amazon.
Or you can, you know, order it into a bookstore, you know.
Yeah.
It can be all major outlets.
Brilliant. And when is the next book expected to drop?
I think it'll be next autumn. So okay. not this autumn coming, so autumn 2018. I was going to say 2008 then. I just lost 10 years.
Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah.
No, because you'd still be at school, Madeline.
Oh, you're right.
You'd be 15.
No! I take it back! I take it back. It was much, yeah. so that's one to look out for next year. An Argument of Blood is available now. I've heard fantastic things about it. It's next on my to-be-read pile, so I'm really looking forward to it. And before we go, Matt, would you like to share any of your social media pages, things like that, so that our listeners can find you?
There is a Facebook page for Oath and Crown, which includes the information about it, reviews, blog posts that we're doing to support it, and a wealth of other supporting stuff. And I think that's probably Facebook/Oath and Crown. But if you search for Oath and Crown on Facebook, you'll find it. My website is airandseastories.com. And on Twitter, I am at Naval Air History.
Brilliant. Well, thank you again for coming to join us. This has been really fascinating. I've really enjoyed this episode. And I hope that you will come onto the show again sometime, Matt.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. Rushing from historical pillar to post.
And to any of our listeners, if you have any particular pivotal points in history that you think you'd like to see more fiction on, or some of your favourite pieces of historical fiction or fantasy, be sure to leave us a comment and tell us what you like, what you don't like, and what you'd like to see more of. So until next week, thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders, or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.